out the goddamn answer?
And a rainy Sunday morning to you at 96.3 FM. And hey, it's Bathroom Spirits Broadsides coming at you yet again for 2.5 hours on December 2nd, 2001, with special guests Ed Davidson and Amy Courtney. Ed's in the studio. Amy will be joining us about an hour. We're talking about affordable housing and some restoration of civil rights up in Scotts Valley, not to mention Camp Paradise, evacuated last night. Stay tuned. December 2nd, 2001 edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. I'm your host, Robert North, and in the studio with me is activist and redevelopment law expert, I dare say that, Ed Davidson. Ed, let's see if your mic is working.
Well, hi this morning.
Talk a little louder and a little closer.
Okay, we're keeping in the
closer and louder. Kiss that mic.
And want to get something to get the ball rolling on this opposition to a program that's been rolling downhill for the last 3 years.
Ed's talking about the Dolphin Lee debacle, as I call it. But before we get into that, we do have a call from activist Becky Johnson, who lives within about 4 blocks of Camp Paradise. She has some distressing news, but some important news. Becky, are you there?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I'm calling on behalf of Friends of Camp Paradise. The camp was flooded out last night between the combination of the coastal flooding and 10 inches of rain up in Ben Lomond last night. So everybody got out all right, but they're down there now at the site trying to rescue their gear, bicycles, that sort of thing. And so Larry Templeton has asked for anybody who can come and help with that effort to come down to the site of Camp Paradise. The Felker Street entrance is blocked due to flooding underneath the Highway 1 bridge, so that pedestrian access is not open right now. He's asking people to come down through Memorial Park Cemetery off of Ocean Street Extension, and it is a paved road that goes right down to the fence to help with saving some of their property. And so any volunteers who can hear this and can spare a couple of hours, or perhaps have a vehicle that could transport some things, bring some hot coffee down. If you've got boots or raincoats, certainly bring them and help out the people at Camp Paradise to rescue their gear. Larry says that the water is up in the kitchen area of the Camp Paradise campsite.
So the flood that was long anticipated by some council members has finally come to pass, eh?
It has come, and we were trying to, of course, with the rains falling, we're trying to keep very close eye on the rising river. However, we were failed when we called the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Department last night at 7:18 p.m. and were assured that there were no reports or no warnings about flooding and that they did not anticipate any flooding in the San Lorenzo River last night. And of course those predictions were proved to be not true.
I think was it you who told me that this flooding is sort of a combination of high tides and the rain both?
That's correct. Both we have a storm tide that is pushing water up the river from the ocean, and then a lot of water falling in the watershed area of the San Lorenzo coming down to meet that water. And so the combination of Camp Paradise basically got the water from both sides.
Well, I know that there was supposedly a resolution by Keith Sugar and Emily Riley as part of their Clear 'em Out enforcement resolution, which passed, I guess, 3 weeks ago now, that also talked about an emergency plan to help. Were city vehicles and city personnel down there last night to help evacuate these folks?
I'm not aware of that, but I wasn't on the scene, so I'd really hate to comment on that. But I was not aware that any staff report had come back in a timely fashion for that kind of evacuation plan.
What about the Red Cross? I understand that they were called.
Larry
and they
apparently called the Red Cross last night to see if they could assist in evacuating the camp. And he was told that even if they were flooded out and had to evacuate, the Red Cross would not help them. And all they would do was refer them to the Homeless Services Center.
Giving them the city council treatment, eh?
Red Cross has been a ways to go in providing aid for all of the citizens of the United States.
Well, it must be said, as I understand it, Mayor Chris Crone did get down there, even though he was one who was partially, well, he was one of the votes that passed this so-called emergency resolution that was supposed to provide for a program and a plan to deal with the flooding, and also, of course, he put the camp in a state of kind of agitated paranoia by talking about enforcement up and down the river with no alternative site. So I understand that there is no alternative site available for Camp Paradise people right now. Is that right?
Not as far as the city goes. They were investigating 3 sites, and there was some talk of a 4th site. And they've pretty much eliminated talk of 2 of those sites. The 2 remaining sites are the Benchlands near San Lorenzo Park,
which are already flooded, I imagine,
and De La Viega Park are the 2 remaining sites.
So they've dumped Harvey West and the Depot site?
No, I was talking about the Poganip site and the Depot site were the 2 that were dropped. I guess the Harvey West site is still on the table, although those staff reports are really slow in coming back.
Right, and they've never been terribly optimistic in the past. No doubt they'll give us many, many obstacles that have to be overcome without any kind of meaningful or hopeful prospects, even though it is an emergency and we're in the middle of a winter storm here, and it's going to get worse not just for Camp Paradise, but for the 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people out there who continue to suffer under the sleeping and camping bans, which Mayor Crone refuses to put on the agenda to rescind over the winter. So, if people want to come down to Camp Paradise, and I guess that's, I should say, swim down to Camp Paradise, or maybe...
No, they can drive their vehicle through the cemetery up to the fence, and there they could be helpful in taking some of the gear and property off, and to some, hopefully they have some locations to take that to.
Is that something else you're looking for, locations to store property?
We certainly are looking for storage facilities for Camp Paradise. We're looking for storage facilities that would be accessible by the campers so that they could get in and out.
Mm-hmm. Now, should people give you a call if they want more information?
You could give me a call. I'm at 429-8529.
429-8529. Of course, you're in the phone book under the Johnson, Becky Johnson.
I'm the only Becky Johnson listed with information in Santa Cruz.
Okay.
You could also give Carl Wilson a call at 425-4787.
He's a little closer to the camp, but I often find his machine has an answering machine on it, and it's more likely, yes, you'll be able to pick up calls, although I understand you're not feeling too well.
I'm kind of staying close to home today.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking with Becky Johnson about the flooding of Camp Paradise, the successful evacuation of folks. I guess there was a successful effort last night. Did you hear anything about that?
I did. I heard that the Quakers were very instrumental in getting down through the cemetery to help make sure that people got out and that their animals got out as well.
Mm-hmm.
That it was the cemetery personnel who came down and opened the gate, not the sheriff.
Nor the city.
Or the city. I know that there were some people who were contacting the sheriff's department and the city in hopes of getting some help, but I haven't heard whether they received that help or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you get more information, do give us a call back. We're also in the studio with us is Ed Davidson, who's going to be talking about the Dolphin Lee gold-plated project, and we'll be... You, I know, have some expertise on the Dolphin Lee. You've done a whole forum on the subject and have written several articles. So
that's correct. And I'll be looking forward to hearing what Ed has to say with the latest on this project, which is going to use up a huge amount of money. They're saying $12.8 million for the project, but that doesn't include the cost of acquisition of the land. So it's over $16 million. To build 48 units on the bones of destroying 63 units of housing. Just any way you look at this project, there's just all kinds of problems with it.
Mm-hmm. Not according to the 6-person majority on the Santa Cruz City Council that passed it, including Mayor Christopher Crone and Mayor, I should say, Council Member Keith. I won't vote for anything that doesn't contain guarantees, double talker sugar.
All of that is sad but true. The only holdout with it was Mark Premack, who voted against the project, saying that it cost too much money and helped too few people.
Yep. Well, thank you for calling in, Becky. Anything you want to add?
I may call back later if I get any more information. I do advise people to continue to listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz this afternoon, and we'll try to get any further updates on the air as soon as we hear something.
And in the meantime, do give Becky Johnson a call for more information about the Camp Paradise situation, if you want to help out with a vehicle or if you want to just be a person who comes down there and helps ferry stuff out of there through the cemetery. Her number is 429-8529. Thanks a lot, Becky.
Sure.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is your free radio station. You don't pay for it. We don't get special commercial spots for folks to dump their trash on your head as you listen through the day. This is your station. If you want more information about free radio, give a call to 427-4523. Or if you want to put a public service announcement on the air, 427-4523. That's the free radio voicemail. We do have slots open for folks to do some programs. If you want to be a programmer here on Free Radio, it doesn't require you to be okayed by the City Council or get a special bill of health from the FBI. You simply have to provide a program that makes sense to our programming committee, and you have to be essentially willing to contribute to the rent of the station. That's the other thing. You have to pay $20 a month and do your show regularly. And it's a real good prospect if you have something you want to say regularly, if there's an area of community life in Santa Cruz that you don't feel is being adequately covered, 427-4523. But getting back to the show and our special guest here, Ed Davidson, has been waiting patiently for 15 minutes to get one word in here. Actually, I think you got a couple words at the beginning, Ed. And I remind you, get real close to the mic. Just kiss that mic. I mean, pretend like it's an ice cream cone. We have rather interesting equipment here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Ed Davidson is with us. He is a former redevelopment worker. How would you describe your history in terms of redevelopment, Ed?
Well, I've worked in redevelopment both in New York City back in the 60s, doing urban renewal under the famous federal programs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've worked in as a consultant in a number of cities in the late 80s and mm-hmm. early 90s.
Right.
And so I have a good deal of experience in both the practical and the theoretical.
Now, redevelopment is always seemed a formidable word to me. I hear the word redevelopment agency meeting, and I immediately sort of switch off. And I think, what the hell is that? I mean, I know about city council meetings where issues come up, but redevelopment, that sounds like some sort of arcane, obscure, specialized part of the law. But it actually just has to do with affordable housing. Isn't that right?
Well, the original purpose of urban renewal comes out of the slum clearance policies from back in the Depression. And the housing issues that were developed from the need to clear out very unhabitable health risk places that used federal funds to clear out the housing, to clear out the slums,
mm-hmm.
and then build replacement housing. It was a good idea then. It's still a good idea to clear slums and improve housing.
And yet I hear that it's so much become a sort of a watchword, particularly in the 60s and 70s, for in San Francisco, for example, for gentrification, for clearing out them Mexicans and blacks and letting the upper middle class whites move in. Is there some truth in that concern?
Well, that was a concern all through the process, and over the years there have been portions added to the law, both as federal law and state law, California law, that protect the current residents and also small business owners from the actions that remove them, and they're supposed to be made whole, in other words, to be relocated into sound housing, and theoretically that they can afford.
Mm-hmm. I just have the impression, I know, listening to county redevelopment agency horror stories, how the county moves into a neighborhood and simply wants to spend its money and develop more funding to, spruce stuff up that the people in the neighborhood don't want change particularly. It's not particularly helpful to them, on which they're not consulted and have no meaningful input. And it's essentially projects that these kind of agencies develop a life of their own and an agenda of their own, which, is there some truth in that?
Well, yes, in a way. What the real issue for redevelopment in California is that when Proposition 13 was passed, and that's almost 25 years ago.
That's the proposition that sort of cut social services back by requiring votes on all taxes and keeping property taxes way down, right?
Right. It became very difficult to raise taxes. And the one loophole was this redevelopment law, which was intended to, as I say, clear out slums and distressed properties. And all of a sudden, since it didn't require a vote of the public, there were no votes required except for a majority of a city council to approve a redevelopment project. And basically, what you're doing is allowing the tax monies from the new project to pay for the infrastructure improvements. And the cost of the infrastructure was unavailable through any other means of tax revenue.
Uh-huh.
And so what happened is that cities discovered this and put it to use in terms of building shopping centers and auto plazas and office buildings.
Everything but low-income housing.
Everything but housing.
Uh-huh.
And where there were...
And cleared out housing along the way, I imagine.
Well, much of it was, either it was in such bad condition that it wasn't habitable, it was not a significant amount of population involved. I give an example of downtown San Jose. That whole area is a redevelopment project area, and you see all these office buildings and arenas and meeting halls and hotels and everything but housing.
Right.
And
in fact, there are plenty, I think, to put the new City Hall smack dab on affordable housing, and that was protested by the Community Homeless Alliance Ministry about 3 or 4 months ago, actually occupied that property. And so
we can go closer to home, and you have Capitola.
Uh-huh.
And their redevelopment project was basically the Capitola Mall and what is now the Auto Plaza and the Browns Market, the Browns Ranch Market. That's basically the redevelopment project area. Mm-hmm. And housing, there were 6 units of housing in the Jimmy Carter's project, which is the
Habitat for Humanity.
Habitat for Humanity. They mm-hmm. put up 6, and the rest of the millions went into essentially the streets and the infrastructure for the mall.
The itsy, glitzy plastic and cement mall that I guess is sort of a tourist attraction, right?
Well, at the time, the real issue for Capitola was that the bridge across Highway 1 on 41st Avenue was only 2 lanes wide. I don't know if you remember back that far, but the 2-lane road made it impossible for any shopping center developer to feel that this was going to be an attractive mall that would attract people and sales dollars.
This was in the 70s, was it?
That was in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
The actual project was adopted in 82, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And their main project was the widening of the Highway 1 overcrossing.
Mm.
And so that enabled a shopping center developer to come in and develop the project.
Now, a certain amount of money has to be apportioned to low-income housing according to, is it state law?
The redevelopment law requires a minimum of 20% of the redevelopment fund be spent on low and moderate income housing. And that's a minimum.
Now, low and moderate income, of course, is a misnomer for a lot of us who think of low income as people being poor people. Poor people don't get into low and moderate income housing, right? They get into extremely low income or very low income, but not low income and moderate. Am I wrong about that? I think it's what? $40,000 or more in our area that's low-income housing, and $60,000 or more that's moderate. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you're not wrong, but the real issue over the past 15, 20 years is that the median income for Santa Cruz has been going up faster than just about any other measurement except for housing prices.
Right, and rents, right, exactly.
But the people buying these newer custom homes or the condos, these are high-income earners, which has been pushing, and like most of the newer parts of Scotts Valley, et cetera, in the last 10 years.
Usually from out of town, right, who come and settle here and sort of displace the locals who've been here for a while.
Well, much of the new housing being built in Santa Cruz County is for commuters over the hill, the dot-com housing market, and we have not been building any rental housing in all those years. And
is that a violation of the spirit, if not the letter, of state law on this?
Well, it's not just the spirit of state law. It's our own adopted policies. We have the Santa Cruz housing element of their general plan since 76.
The Santa Cruz County or city?
City, and also in the county. But the city's general plan housing policy is to have a balance between ownership and rental in new housing development. And the majority of the new housing in the rental side has been subsidized housing, mostly senior subsidized housing. That doesn't do very much for the people who are working at service job wages, even what we would consider middle class types of work in public agency employees, nursing and teachers, police and fire. Mm-hmm. They can't afford to live here. And that would be middle income type wages, but middle income here is really so high now that really you have to limit to just low income families because of the current wage limits and the excessive amount of new people coming in who are making six-figure kind of incomes.
Limit to low income, you mean limit building housing to simply low income for low income people?
Right. In other words, for the rental housing that gets built, I think they're going to pretty much limit it to, again, what you're calling the $40,000 a year, which is the low income level.
But not the very low or the extremely low, right? Which are the people? I'm thinking the people who I know who call into this station, most of them are really very low or extremely low. That which is, I guess, what, 20,000 and even below 20,000, right?
Well, if there are two different things you're dealing with. One is a family incomes, and one is individual for single people.
Right.
And you have to remember that half the households in Santa Cruz are one- or two-person households.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they don't need the three-bedroom type of condo that is the typical, or the four- or five-bedroom house that are being built.
Mm-hmm.
And they need the studios and one-bedrooms and even the single-room occupancy kind of housing,
mm-hmm,
for singles. And that's not being built.
Now, the redevelopment agency, the city redevelopment agency, is headed by Cecil Cirillo, who probably is one of the most highly paid public officials. Perhaps Dick Wilson gets more than she does in the city, hundreds of $100,000 to $200,000. I'm not sure exactly what her salary is, but it's big. And I have often attacked her as one of the architects of the Dolphin Lee plan. She and Elizabeth Vogel have proposed and pushed through this to the city council and the redevelopment agency. This plan to displace and destroy, well, first destroy the housing of the Dolphin Lee and Rex Court tenants, and then to relocate, I would have to say, some of them, certainly not all of them, into new housing that actually creates less units, though admittedly more bedrooms than the old housing, at a cost of millions and millions and millions of dollars. In fact, I think it's all the CDBG funding for the next 5 years. $250,000 of it a year is going to be taken up with the community center stuff that they're building, and all the affordable housing money. I heard it was 5 years. Then I've heard it was 5 to 17 years. How much money is actually going to be taken up in terms of the affordable housing money with the Dolphin Lee project for the next decade or so?
Well, the affordable housing fund, which is building every year as tax revenues from the completed redevelopment areas. And those are the downtown buildings and also newer buildings anywhere in our commercial districts and industrial districts. The tax increments from those new properties are all into the redevelopment fund. And as we know, 20% of that must be set aside for housing.
And I guess the city council upped that figure to 25%?
They did up the figure for the
city?
For the next foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you're not spending the money in a way that benefits the housing problems in Santa Cruz,
it's meaningless.
It's meaningless. You can put 100% of the fund in there if you're not using it to increase your housing supply.
Well, let me play devil's advocate here, and let me get you to answer that question first. Is it 5 years' worth of affordable housing money that's going into the Dolphin Lee, or is it more than 5 years, or is it less?
I'm going to guess it's 8 years. That's just an educated guess, but I have to tell you that 1 year's worth has already been spent on grants to Mercy Charities to develop the housing plan in the first place. So we've already spent a year's worth before we even bought any property. That's gone.
Right. Now, I mean, there's also, and you're pointing out generally, I mean, I'm gonna kind of keep kind of a focus in and then sort of zoom away from Dolphin Lee and the Mercy Charities Housing's pet project there that they essentially have a blank check for, it looks like, from City Council. I want to talk about it more, but I also want to look at the whole picture, which is the redevelopment agency's activities for the last 20 years in Santa Cruz. You've been keeping an eye on it. You come to City Council. You're one of the few people who comes and speaks at the redevelopment agency meetings, which usually precede the evening edition of the City Council session, the evening session. What have been the accomplishments of the redevelopment agency, and as a critic of the redevelopment agency, what has it not accomplished that it should have accomplished in the last two decades?
Well, let me get back to the first redevelopment project we had here, which is interesting. The 1955 flood wiped out much of the area in the downtown, severe damage, and the first project that the city had was take the area bounded by Water Street, Ocean, Soquel, and Front Street, and clear the entire project with the exception of the post office and the Veterans Hall. That whole area was cleared out, and over time, what came in there, the County Government Center and the Holiday Inn, shopping center and offices on Soquel, shopping center on the corner of Soquel in front, which is the Longs and Zanatos, and the parking structure in the banking buildings along South River. And that project was filled out and finalized in the 70s, and the project ended, I think, very successfully. It did what it was supposed to do.
Now, did it replace the housing that was destroyed?
There wasn't an issue in those days. The people who were flooded out of their houses, and that was where our little Chinatown was in the old days, they all found housing outside because, as I say, the flood had destroyed the housing that was there. And housing was built. We had some federal programs. And the 20% fund wasn't part of redevelopment law way back then. But the purpose of the project was to bring the property back from the damage of the floods. And it was successful in that every property is built on.
We're talking about the 50s to the 70s. How about the last 20 years from 1980 on through 2001 now?
Well, the original projects that were part of redevelopment after the 70s were very limited in area. They were just a little bit of the downtown and part of North River Street. And that North River Street was added when they were trying to get an auto plaza to locate where the Crossroads Shopping Center is now. And not much was happening until the earthquake. And in 1989, following the earthquake, they took in the whole of the beach area south of Laurel and all of the commercial districts out Soquel all the way to the city limits, Water Street out to the...
This is a vast expansion of redevelopment agency authority?
Area, right, that was involved. All of Ocean Street, the commercial frontage on Ocean Street, all of Mission Street, Harvey West, West Side Industrial Park, that all came into the redevelopment project area.
And the funding, I imagine, expanded exponentially?
Well, the amount of revenue, the tax revenues, were needed to do all of the earthquake repairs. So it was a source of funds we could borrow against in order to make all the infrastructure repairs.
St. George and other hotels and motels were either destroyed or disabled in the earthquake, and of course there's been this gentrification process that we see happening in San Francisco where SROs are destroyed to make way for fancy tourist hotels or other shopping-type deals. Has that been happening here in Santa Cruz as well, and has affordable housing been rebuilt in the last 10 years in any significant way?
Well, the new project, there were two projects that preceded this that would be for non-seniors, for all-age residents. The first one, of course, is the Neary Lagoon project, which actually preceded the redevelopment, preceded the earthquake, and was done under another kind of federal low-moderate housing program. And then came the Sycamore Street housing project 5 or 6 years ago. And those are basically the two projects. There have been other little
run by Mercy Housing, or Mercy Charities Housing, as it called itself then.
Right. But and the there have been other little guys, including helping the mobile home parks become co-ops and ownership for the space residents, and a few other rehab for existing housing.
Well, Mike, I'm trying to get some sense though. You're describing what they've done, but have they done what they said they were going to do? Have they done what is needed to be done? Have they been using the money wisely and fairly? Has affordable and low-income and very low-income housing been built in the Santa Cruz area? By the way, in case anybody out there wants to listen, well, hopefully you're listening, but wants to call in, we do have a phone number here, 427-3772, 427-3772. If you'd like to join me and redevelopment expert Ed Davidson looking over the Santa Cruz City, to me it's a debacle, but again, I'm trying to educate myself here. Maybe I'm being a little too hard on poor Seal Cirillo and Mayor Chris Crone. I mean, after all, Chris did get down there and probably got his shoes wet last night in Camp Paradise, and I thank him for that. I didn't get down to Camp Paradise last night. I was busy phoning people up. But we revert again to the... I'll ask you one more time about the affordable housing. Have we been getting the needed bang for the buck for affordable housing by the redevelopment agency, or has it been, in essence... we've heard a lot about inclusionary housing buyouts, for example. I don't know if that has to do with redevelopment or if that has to do with just what private developers are supposed to do. Maybe you can clarify that for us, too. That's money that everybody who builds in Santa Cruz is supposed to put in some kind of low-income or affordable housing. Is that right? Or?
Well, there is a requirement if you're building enough units to build inclusionary, affordable units. Unfortunately, what we've been building has been ownership units, i.e. condos, and the middle income, moderate income, that is $65,000 a year income type people, have been eligible to buy into one of these ownership units. And that does not do very much for the crisis in rental housing, which is the real housing issue here in Santa Cruz.
Can you underline this crisis? Do you have any sense of stats around the rental crisis or how it's gotten worse over the last couple decades? Do you have anything you want to sock us with that, Ed?
Well, I don't think anybody in this town needs to be told what the crisis is here. I think it's just evident on its face. The rents have been going up way faster than incomes have been going up. We are getting people who have to choose between having a shelter over their head or food on the table. That's what's happening here. Mm-hmm. And the council is totally oblivious to the real hardships that are being put on the people of Santa Cruz, the old-time, long-term renters. Now, there are plenty of landlords in town who have been here for a long time, who have tenants, long-time tenants, maybe in a converted garage or some other kind of makeshift housing, who are not gouging their tenants because they have long-term tenants and they have a good relationship, and they're not gouging. But as soon as these larger projects get sold to some out-of-town consortium, the rents just go to whatever the market will bear.
Isn't there a Cypress Point scandal about 9 months ago or so where a huge number of units were bought by this Texas company?
Right, and that's not a scandal. It's just the way business works. We have an undersupply of rental housing, and the landlords, taking the basic laws of economics, raise the rents because they can get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the city, of course, could do things like a rent freeze, right?
Well, that's a little bit complicated under the law, especially since much of the rental housing is in small units, that is single family or duplexes, and they cannot be affected by rent control laws, and that's a state policy. But nonetheless,
a significant number of units could be affected in terms of a rent freeze or rent control or even a rent rollback, right?
Well, that would take a lot of work to get the voters to pass it because the city council doesn't appear to have any interest in doing it.
But in theory, the city council could do that in the course of, well, one emergency session or two regular sessions, right?
I suppose they could.
Right. If
it was a will. I mean, they seem to have tried to do something about the living wage for the city employees.
Right.
And I think that everyone on the council was kind of a support of it, but that took a while to happen.
Right.
So it's not that their hearts are in the wrong place, it's just that their minds are in the wrong place. I mean, not one of the council members or any of the politicians who have been here and been elected over the last 20 years has ever said that they're not in favor of affordable housing. It's just that they just will not do anything about it once they get into office.
Well, I think that it's very nice for, you know, I mean, I frankly, I mean, that means to me they're not in favor of affordable housing. I mean, it's very nice of them to say they are in favor and then do nothing about it, but that kind of posturing is meaningless if you're not acting on it. Similarly, we've heard them say the same thing about community control of police, about ending the sleeping ban, about setting up campgrounds for low-income people, about open process at city council, and of course we see the opposite happening when it comes down to it. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to be an easy road or you're going to be able to do it with a snap of your fingers, but obviously if someone persistently wishes to pursue objectives at city council, they can keep bringing them up and they can keep mobilizing public support for them. I haven't seen any city council member do that for rent control or, in fact, any of the other issues I've mentioned. Have you?
Well, no. I will say if you want to get into the height of cynicism, we really have to look at this Dolphin Lee project. This is, without any question, and I've been observing the city council for more than 30 years, the single worst decision I have seen in all those years. This is a project which demolishes 47 units of usable...
63, actually, if you count Rex Court.
...of usable housing and replaces it with a similar number of expensive housing.
Although there's actually more living space, right, because they're building upward to three or four stories, and it's two or three times the number of, quote, bedrooms?
Yeah, the units that will be built, that would be built if they go forward with the project, would be nice units. They'd be lovely units. These are $300,000 units if you were to buy them as condos. These are the people who are going to benefit from this. That is, some of the current residents. They've hit the jackpot. But the problem is that redevelopment housing fund was supposed to help to meet the housing needs in the community, and it should not be all blown on one project that doesn't help anyone except for the people who are currently living in the project.
And I believe, and I've said this repeatedly, you may disagree with me, that it doesn't really help all the people who are living in that project. What it does is it helps those who are willing to stick around for 2 years while it's built, those who meet the requirements of Mercy Housing, and they've repeatedly said, it's just income requirements, but of course that leaves out single men who are working and sharing housing together to send money back to their families down south in Guatemala, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, Mexico. It does not benefit every person in there in terms of even that particular population. I know that your issue is a broader one, and I think a legitimate one. My issue has been, even considering, if you're just trying to help the people in it, it doesn't even benefit those people because the city council has been unwilling to stipulate that those people who are leaving the property will get guarantees of relocation funding while it's being built and return to the actual housing when it's finished. Am I wrong about that?
Well, in a way, you're right. There are no ironclad guarantees, but the one thing that they did adopt as a policy is that these people are entitled to these units regardless of citizenship or immigration status. Now, we have at the Housing Authority a list of people wanting subsidized housing that is, I'm told, 7 years wait. If you're you have to be on the list for at least 7 years before something becomes available. The people who are in the project now, they're the ones who have the first right to get in there. The heck with the 7-year list of people who've been waiting patiently for Housing Authority to find a unit for them. And the heck with everybody else in town who are not going to get any benefits from these millions of dollars in the housing fund that was required to be set aside from the redevelopment tax income.
Let's be play devil's advocate here. This is a group of Hispanic folks who live there, Latino folks, low-income people, and it does seem to benefit them particularly. And why not? They need this kind of assistance. They have shoddy housing. I, of course, have disagreed. I've thought that they never did a publicly published report that showed that this housing couldn't be at least significantly refurbished to extend its lifetime for a significant period of time. That's one thing. A second thing is, what about rents? We know that they raised the Rodriguez property rent outrageously nearby. Aren't we trying to protect these folks from rent increases? We actually got a quick call. Before you answer that question, let me hold your answer because we want to catch this caller. I'll repeat the question after the call's over.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yes, is this Robert Norris?
It is.
Robert Norris, this is Jane, and we're calling from DeSoto, Missouri.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering how things are going. I've been getting messages about the Camp Paradise being flooded out.
Could you, Jane, speak up a bit. We're having trouble hearing you, but definitely going to talk to you here.
Okay. Is that better?
That's better.
Okay.
Yeah, we have in the studio with us your old friend Ed Davidson. You remember Ed?
Hi.
Can you actually hear? I guess you aren't listening to your computer. You could hear us on your computer out there in Missouri if you wanted to, you know.
Yeah, no, I just brought up the. I can't do both because I only have one line.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, when you're finished, listen in on www.microradio.net.
Okay.
That's something that puts us out all over the country, in fact, all over the world. So if you want to hear this show and you want to hear homeless activist Jane Immler, who's actually been, she was one of the people who helped start our original shelter program back in 1985. Welcome, Jane.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to hear you. Keep talking loud.
Okay, try to do that, okay?
How's your health? We know that you've been moving along on one kidney there.
Phone people came in, and we put in a new phone line upstairs and put in a new computer thing, and so I thought it's finally time to start writing. I know I've said that before, but it's kind of desperation time now. So.
Well, that's great. I know that you you did get a lot of plaudits in Paul Lee's most recent book. You may have written something since, but I don't think so. The Quality of Mercy, which talks about the struggles of the homeless civil rights and shelter movement Santa Cruz in the 80s and I guess the early 90s, and you had a bone or two to pick with Paul, I know that.
Oh, yes. Well, that's part of what my writing is going to be, is being the Quality of Mercy Revisited.
Oh, good.
Because there was quite a few omissions left out, things that were left out, so I thought if we're really going to have an accurate history of that period of time, I think maybe it needs to be redone.
Now, I should tell the audience out there that for those who don't know you, that you actually you came to Santa Cruz after doing some work in the L.A. Tent City, and where I guess you were working at UCSC finishing your thesis or something, or
mm-hmm.
And you then became involved in the homeless civil rights struggle here, and in 1985 you began a hunger strike that lasted for 33 days, and
I think it was about 31
days, and it resulted in the city's opening the cold and rainy night Cedar Street shelter, right?
That, and also it allowed Peter Kuroda to put 25 people in his soup kitchen at night.
Uh-huh.
Because all of his permits had been turned down. So we did manage to do those two things. But it's been very interesting because, you know, the FBI at that time, via Arnie Levine, said that I was a terrorist.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know, you know, now what that puts me. I guess I'm, you know, still on that terrorist list.
Well, if not, we'll inform the FBI immediately. Ed Davidson wants to make a comment. Let him talk to you on the phone here, because I don't think you'll be able to hear him otherwise.
Okay.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, Ed. How are you?
Okay. I you remember Carl Foytek, who was so active in the homeless?
Yeah, right.
He was in Santa Cruz this past year. He's been in Hawaii for 15 years.
Whoa.
And he was successful in challenging the state's welfare reform legislation.
Mm-hmm.
He took the case as a citizen all the way to the Hawaii Supreme Court, and he won. And they had
wow.
to reform the changes they were doing in the latest welfare reform bill. And so he's now in a law school at the University of Hawaii.
Wow, that's impressive. That's really great. That's wonderful.
And we all remember how much important work you did back then, and he was involved too. So
yes, very definitely.
There were a lot of folks then. So yes. I just wanted to let you know that.
Okay, hope you're well.
Thanks.
Okay.
So, Jane, you wanted an update from about Camp Paradise, and I'll repeat that for the benefit of listeners. Camp Paradise was flooded out last night, but not much thanks to the city. The city government successfully evacuated at least the people and some of their possessions. And today, for those who are listening, they're still looking for trucks, shelter space, and a place to store their stuff, and for folks to help move it. And for people who want to come on down and help out, you can come to the cemetery, the Oddfellows Cemetery off of Ocean Street Extension, go all the way around to the open gate that borders Camp Paradise on the river, and you can help them do some moving. You probably want to have some rain gear and some boots or some hefty shoes, or not be afraid of getting your feet wet, since a lot of the camp is underwater. And we're, of course, looking for a place to set up a new campground, since there has to be a place for people to go. They can't live in the air or float on the sea. They have to have some real place to go. I know you had proposed different campgrounds. In fact, that was part of your hunger fast back in 1985. And then again the next year, I guess, you did another fast, right?
Exactly, yes. We were looking for campgrounds at that time, too. And one of the places that had been, we talked about was Sycamore Grove. And actually, that year was very rainy in 85, just like it is this year. And the state had closed down the state parks there in Santa Cruz area, so people were being run out of there. And so it all sort of came together in some ways, although, it seems like deja vu now, because with all the stuff that's going on and so many homeless and it's raining again, you're not getting a whole lot of cooperation.
No, I know. In fact, it seemed to require direct action to get City Council and to get the Board of Supervisors to get off its respective butts. I know in 1986 the River Street mini shelter, as I called it, was bogged down, and there was a refusal to proceed on that. And I guess Marty Wormhout called you a terrorist. Was that right? Or
well, I don't know if she called me a terrorist, but it was Arnie Levine who said that the FBI, when they had talked to the FBI, and that was in 85, had called me a terrorist. But part of the problem in 86 was they wanted us to do the River Street. They wanted the River Street shelter site, and some of us, Wendell Master and myself, and a couple other people, because there was a group of us that did a hunger strike in 86, didn't feel like that was really a very good site, because it was so toxic. You're sitting right there on that whatever that cement plant is or something there, plus being right there at the highway. But we kind of got overridden. But anyway, they eventually did get their shelter, whatever you want to call it.
We've been talking about Paul Lee, and you and Paul Lee and Paige Smith and Fred Gray all formed the Citizens Committee for the Homeless back in 1985.
Right.
And I guess they were walking up and down with a placard saying "Save Jane Immler's Life," and they were getting funds and trying to pressure the City Council to open up the Cedar Street shelter. And I guess the third prong of your program, as well as legalizing Peter Carota's soup kitchen, which is now the St. Francis Soup Kitchen, was to get the camping ban repealed, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, because they'd even strengthened it, and that was part of the work Shannon Consamo did, kind of simultaneously with what I was working on. And, but instead of weakening it, it just strengthened it, and all this seemed to kind of come together at one time. And they just started setting up task forces, and then they would, then they would disband task forces.
Are you accusing Sue Mariello of doing nothing?
Right. Yeah.
One of the
she's
highest
still
paid.
Around?
Oh yeah, she still runs the show at the county.
Oh goodness. Yeah, like I said, it's totally utterly amazing that this is still going on, and it doesn't seem like now the progressives are the Greens. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean to step on anybody's parties, but
feel free.
But the stripes are the same. Nothing's changed.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the Green Party, at least some Green Party members, have evolved from trying to evict me from the party and protect their Green Party, phony Green Party mayor, Tim Fitzmaurice, who's no longer mayor. Our new mayor is Christopher Crone. They are actually out there trying to help Camp Paradise folks relocate. They have passed resolutions not quite condemning Mayor Fitzmaurice, former Mayor Fitzmaurice, but referring to the fact that politicians are obliged to deal with the Green Party plank, which says no anti-homeless sleeping bans. Mm-hmm. So there is sort of some incremental movement in that direction. Paul Lee, your old, your former colleague, and I guess also your, how would we call it? Nemesis, antagonist. He's also been putting up, proposing money for Camp Paradise, and he's personally putting everybody up in motels, as I understand. He's put up a lot of money to put people up in the motels, at least last night, in order to save them their butts after the evacuation. So he's getting some plaudits from local activists here for doing that. Of course, he has been showing up at city council meetings trying to press his Santa Cruz Service Corporation proposal, which city council is endlessly delaying and putting off, which is a proposal to, you know, have homeless people in campground situations like Camp Paradise camp in Greenbelt or just in areas of the city where they then camp there lightly and temporarily for a period of time and work to do the kind of brush clearing and environmental restoration that apparently the city can't afford for workers. And they would be doing it free for their lodging. I guess it's Santa Cruz slave labor with the benefit of you get a place to live, which is, you know, I guess something. People need a place to live. And Lee and others have agreed to finance this, but they want the city to kick in something and the city to, you know, okay it. And the city, of course, has been postponing any kind of report on it until the next and last city council meeting of the year, which is the second Tuesday, a week from 10 days from today or so in December.
Well, this is all, you know, I don't know. I get this really peculiar feeling about all this. I mean, it's like this is the same scenario we've had time and time and time again. I say we, I'm no longer there. But that the homeless have had time and time again. You know, Paige and Paul, and Paige is no longer around, I realize that, come in with these wonderful plans, and before you know it, they've totally destroyed the movement. This is my great concern, and you made some comment in one of your emails in the last day or so, which I was strongly applauding about, that, you know, don't get blindsided by this service corps. And Linda LeMaster sent out an email last night or this morning and said, you know, it's important to keep that camp together, whether they, you know, that's, you know, it'd be great to get them inside, but you've got a good thing going there as far as any kind of a homeless movement. You know how difficult it is, that somehow you got just can't let them slither away. And I get so tired of people believing that the only thing homeless can do is pick up trash. I mean, that's been going on for 16 years. Remember that one big trash pickup we had up there at some camp?
I do.
I don't know.
Well, you know, we can prove by
right. I'm sorry, it just doesn't smell right.
No, it doesn't. There's a stench to the whole thing. You know, the idea that, well, yes, boss, we have to prove we're a good Negro in order to, you know, we pick up the trash and you give us civil rights. You know,
exactly.
That's how
exactly.
It doesn't work that way, unfortunately. You have to demand it. Of course, the problem for homeless people, as you know, is holding a tent city. You're familiar with this.
Oh, yeah.
Is not the easiest thing to do. What we need is people with houses to build that tent city and to maintain it, like Sherry Connable's group did back in 1990, you may remember, at City Hall. But, of course, they only stayed for 10 days, and then they disappeared, and then the next day the police came in and arrested the Huff people who were there and removed us. But this time, Camp Paradise has gotten lots of favorable publicity. A local court has ruled, even though it's not a necessity for people to sleep, you know, they can always, you know, pin their eyes open with thumbtacks and wander around. It is a necessity. You know, they've ruled that the camp was a good thing, that it was provided a better living environment, that the campers should be commended. In fact, they suspended the sentences of the two people who were found guilty. Actually, all four were found guilty. All four had sentences suspended, two for disability purposes and two because of the former work they'd done for helping the city. So the Camp Paradise has gotten lots of favorable publicity, and what's needed now is for the activists to get out there and build a tent city like Dignity Village or Share up in Seattle, where they actually had a functioning tent city for a year and a half, at least in Share. I think it's been longer. Dignity Village was built last December in Portland, Oregon. And it's illegal, and they get hassled, and there's going to be all this pressure. But if people in houses do it, and they do it because there is a shelter need, and that's documented, there's no shelter for 90% at least of the homeless community in Santa Cruz, then there is going to be a real pressure on the city council to back off, particularly if we get a couple of lawyers involved. So
we, you know, that was like in L.A. We started out with that homeless organizing. It was called HOT, Homeless Organizing Team. And this was basically housed people who set up the tent city, which was originally just for a week, and then some of us refused to shut it down, so it went from two weeks. And out of that then, and I've forgotten the man's name, he started another tent city that just moved around Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Their own payphones. They had, you know, it was, and I think that's an excellent idea, and it would be, this is a great time to do it, because we set ours up for Christmas week and then stay the next week.
It's an essential time to do it, because Camp Paradise is gone. It is,
yeah.
It's glub. It's
right.
Underwater now, and Camp Paradise people are dispersed in the homes and of supporters, but unless they get together again, there won't be a Camp Paradise.
That's right. That's right.
It's got to be built by the rest of us who have the luxury of homes, and who have the luxury of places to live, rooms that we're in.
Right.
And if people want to be a part of this project, I encourage them to give a call to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUF. We're talking with Jane Immler in the studio with us. We have Ed Davidson, who's one of our guests, and we have some new guests who just arrived. We're waiting patiently. These are women who I believe are going toe-to-toe with the Scotts Valley Police Department, hanging up treasonous signs about why are we bombing Afghanistan. What's wrong with these terrorist types, man? I don't know what to say. It's just pretty bad.
Right.
I called the FBI.
Robert, I'm not going to take any more of your time. I just wanted to let you know that 2,000 miles away, my thoughts and prayers are with everybody out there. And hopefully, you know, it sounds like you got something good going. And I was also encouraged to hear that you've got an alliance up on campus. Right.
Well, there's a new organization up there called Students Against the Sleeping Ban, or HUF UCSC,
uh-huh.
which
uh-huh.
Is a bold thing for any student to do, is to form
yeah.
a HUF on campus. I don't think Mike Rotkin would like it, and I'm sure Tim Fitzmaurice would give us a major scowl
right.
on that one. So
anyway, but like I said, I won't keep you on the line, but I just wanted to let you know that I wanted kind of an update, and also to let you know that I'm with you in spirit, if nothing else.
Hey, Jane, and I expect to see the first installation of that book, which, of course, you promised 9 years ago.
Well, I'm making progress, honey. I'm sitting up here on the second floor.
I have utmost faith in you.
Okay.
Hey, good to
okay.
hear you, Jane.
Okay, take care. Brother.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, that was Martha Jane Immler, also known as Calamity Jane, calling in from her terrorist cave in St. Oh. Louis. FBI has been looking for her, but without success, and we assume she will continue to elude them. Actually, she's probably a less dramatic a situation than that, but she really is. She's one of the founding mothers of the homeless civil rights struggle here in Santa Cruz, along with Linda LeMaster, Shannon Casamo, Ray Glock Grunike, and other people who are unsung, not to mention myself. Pat myself on the back a few times here. Ed, poor Ed here has been... hasn't really gotten to the meat of his criticism of the Dolphin Lee. Let me ask you, Ed, have you got time to give the women who've arrived a chance to talk? They were kind of scheduled for noon. What's your time look like?
Well, I'm going to have to go, but I will get a few points in, and then.
Okay, Ed's going
to
make a few brief points here. Go ahead.
Well, my first point is that this project has cut so many corners on the law that it is now officially a circle, and the details, not because of the press of time, I can't go into details.
Our other guests are graciously offering you a little more time, but proceed with all dispatch.
Just one example. They're putting up a four-story wall in a four-story, one of the new buildings. Would be a four-story wall that's within 10 feet of the property line, and there is a duplex in the backyard. A typical two-story, one or two-story unit, which is typical of the Beach Flats area. So the project itself is not only out of scale with everything else that's in Beach Flats, and out of character with that, but it cuts off the solar access to this adjacent unit.
We're talking about the Dolphin Lee project. You're listening to Ed Davidson, redevelopment expert, on the city's biggest boondoggle in a decade, where all the affordable housing money for the next, Ed predicts, 8 years goes into this project. Go ahead, Ed.
I've seen this council go for more than an hour about the solar access of a granny unit in the backyard of somebody's single-family house. this they can talk for an hour about, but when you're talking about a four-story building backed up to one and two-story housing next door, not a word. They just pass it on. So it's just typical of how this thing has been just shoot along, coming out of the ill-fated Third Street realignment.
Which is, of course, another thing. These voters voted down the Third Street realignment Seaside Company development plan that would have destroyed a lot of housing in the beach flats, given established an outlet center down there, given the Canfield Company much more room to expand. This was the Kennedy-Rotkin-Matthews plan to proceed, and it was voted out by the voters in 1998. But interestingly enough, the Dolphin Lee plan you were telling me, Ed, is very carefully tailored to allow for the return of the Third Street realignment in this development plan, right?
That's right. And actually, the original planning for that housing development associated with the Third Street realignment, this is sort of the remnants of the money that the city gave to Mercy Charities to do some housing planning. That housing plan went into the beach area plan, and after the Third Street realignment was cut from the project by the three council members who rode into success on the basis of their opposition to the Third Street realignment, the remnants of that are what this project is, and it's designed in such a way that the Third Street realignment can still be accomplished. But what they've done is they've, in order to get this project through, because it is in conflict with the Coastal Act policies and their own adopted local coastal program, they have delayed the city application for the certification of the beach area plan to the Coastal Commission. So we've been waiting for an extra 3 years already, and it looks like it's going to be another whole year before the commission actually takes it up.
Ed, you're an expert kind of in the arcane details, which I think are important because the devil is sometimes in the details here, and I have here page 2 of your letter. I can't find page 1, which describes the 10 worst aspects of the plan. I'm going to read them very briefly. Demolition of 47 units of low-income housing. It expends 5 to 8 years' worth of the redevelopment housing fund. The benefits of the new $250,000 apartments are limited to current occupants or those selected by Mercy Charities. There's no relocation available for low- and moderate-income individuals, as distinguished from families. The uncertified RTE district allows half the parking required by current zoning of the certified local coastal program. Abandonment of Lee Brandt Street removes public parking for beach flats, residents, and off-season visitors. The 40-foot, four-story triangular building blocks solar access. You were just talking about that for Raymond Street residences and the daycare center playground. Pile driving adjacent to occupied residences will take several weeks. Site retains the Third Street realignment option. We talked about that. And the project would compromise, and you were just discussing this, which is somewhat more difficult because we're not conversant with the law, numerous provisions of the Coastal Act, California Redevelopment Law, and possibly the Uniform Relocation Law and Mellow Act. The point of this is it hasn't been a transparent process. It hasn't been a process involving public participation. It has been a process behind closed doors pushed by Elizabeth Vogel, Catherine Byers, then later Tim Fitzmaurice, and, of course, now and all the way along, Cecil Cirillo and the Redevelopment Agency, but not one that really looks at the genuine needs and the desires of people in the beach flats and people in the, and as you point out, low-income people in the city generally. Ed, I'm by next week, I'm going to hope to have actually listened to the long tape of the last city council meeting in which, I guess, they okayed 6-1 the Dolphin Lee Project's operating agreement. And we're going to be talking a bit more about it, although some will say, why are we talking about this thing? It's a done deal. Well, nothing's done until the cement is laid, and that's a lot of money to throw at a very small group of people, and particularly when you're sending some of those people down the road without housing. So I want to thank you, Ed, for coming in today, and would you like to sum up before we toss you out of the studio and give your mic to these two women who've come in?
Well, thanks for tossing me, yeah. But...
you can take over the show. I got things to do.
Actually, the thing that really is gets to me is the irony of having the three council members who were elected on the basis of their opposition to the Seaside Company's takeover of the boardwalk expansion and the beach area and the hotel, luxury hotels, etc., how they rode to victory on those policies, and when the policy comes before them that they were so opposed to, they disappear into the woodwork of the same mentality that they had opposed when they were running for election. That's the turnaround that bothers me more than anything else, that they would even consider a project that wastes the entirety of our redevelopment housing fund on a project that does not increase the amount of affordable housing.
But in fact decreases it in terms of both availability, because the money's gone, but also in terms of the number of units that were there before. You've been listening to Ed Davidson, and I'm your host, Robert Norse. On Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, we are the Pirate Station Mateys. So we will, as the pirates of old used to do, we are attempting to reclaim basic rights and basic right-of-ways for the community and for the public that have been taken. And we hope that you will help us. We hope you will be a part of this process. You can join us at 423-4833. Actually, that's the Huff line. You can join us there off air, but you can join us on air at 427-3772. That's Free Radio Santa Cruz. And it looks like somebody is. Maybe before Ed leaves, there may be a question for him. So let's see who's on the phone. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is Judith. I wanted to ask Mr. Davis. Hi, Robert.
Davidson.
Davidson. Okay, that piece of property on the mall between... on Cathcart between Pacific and Front Street, where the gateway is. What's going on? Is there going to be housing built in there?
Go ahead, Ed.
Yes, there is a project which is coming forward, has not only council approval, but it's a fabulous project, and it's a very worthwhile project, and it'll have 40% of the units will be affordable to low and moderate income renters, and this is all rental projects. We need rental housing, and there will be 60% market rate rents and 40% reduced rents.
And that, of course, is different from the Dolphin Lee, which is a subsidized project. There, people can move in there, and they will be only have to pay 30% of their income, which is quite different than a rental property.
And who's doing that? Who's behind it? And are they going to take out the palm trees? I guess they will.
Yes, they're taking out the palm trees.
So, I guess that's good news then.
I hate to tell you this, but affordable housing is in much more demand than palm trees.
I know. Well, that's good news, because I've been really wondering why no one has been talking about that, because I heard that it was all going, and of course, the Pontiac Grill closed down, and it just seemed kind of sad.
Well, I know there was some, maybe I'm thinking of another project, there was some concern about tenants there not being consulted, or tenants of another project. You talked, I guess, to one of the tenants of another project that was... complaining, I guess El Centro was
uh-huh.
But we can talk about that at another time. Let me, is there more you want to say to
no,
Ed Davidson?
No, I just, when is that project going to be done? In a couple of years, do you know, or who's?
Ed nods, says 2 years.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for your show.
Hey,
Robert.
Thank you, Judith.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
And we are actually going to allow these two guests in, provided they give their $50 membership fee. Just kidding, of course. Mike, as I like to colorfully put it. Ed, thank you very much for being with us. You may have read in the Sentinel of yesterday, removal of anti-war signs sparks protests by John D. Gums. That's a new name to me at the urinal, or Sentinel, as some like to call it. Anti-war protesters marched outside Scotts Valley City Hall Friday afternoon, complaining police had violated their First Amendment rights by removing a protest sign from a fence overlooking Highway 17. The sign read, "At what cost?" next to the image of a skeleton. Protesters Cassandra Brown and Amy Courtney, who we have in the studio with us, sign in, Amy. Say hello.
Hi.
And who have you brought with you? Who is this other traitor who's joining us?
Yeah, let's keep the terrorist lingo down. We don't want to tip them off too much. Cassandra Brown.
Real close. Oh, we've got Cassandra, too. Cool.
Yeah.
All right, so these so-called terrorists, we don't want to, you know, they're just alleged. We don't actually know that they are. Protesters Cassandra Brown and Amy Courtney said a flag was hanging there. Professional, probably paid for by Osama bin Laden dollars. In fact, we're tracing the funding now. Said a flag. Oh, please spare us your special pleading. Don't believe any of this. Said a flag was hanging there too, so they figured it was okay. Police Chief Tom Bush, that's a Scotts Valley police chief, said the sign, a white bedsheet, wasn't fastened as securely as the flag. Ha! No wonder. I knew there was a reason. And could have come loose and landed on northbound cars. So he was just protecting the automobiles. I see. That's good to hear. These are concerned, police chief. Caltrain generally prohibits signs on freeway overpasses, but has allowed flags to be displayed since the September 11th terrorist attacks. Bush, that's Tom Bush, not George Bush, said. Smaller sign that says Santa Cruz loves New York is still attached to the overpass. Bush said that sign is fastened inside the fence where it couldn't fall on motorists. The police didn't get complaints on that sign, just the bed sheet. We're not picking sides, he said. About 20 people participated in the protest. They said they wanted to make a statement against the American bombing of Afghanistan that started in response to the attacks, which killed several thousand people. Brown, 32, a writer and teacher at a private school, wore a sign that read how many Afghans have died. Courtney, 27, who works on a farm, said she didn't understand the exception being made for the flag. Many voices need to be represented, she said. After speaking to television and newspaper reporters, they tied gags around their mouths and marched in silence. Two of them carried a red, white, and blue flag in which a peace symbol replaced the white stars. Freedom of speech is all about us, said Gabriel of Santa Cruz. Scotts Valley resident Tyler Mercier, who drove by the protest, said he found it objectionable. You're supporting a dictatorial totalitarian state, he told Courtney. Put your sign up where you live. That's from yesterday's Sentinel, or Sentinel, as some like to call it. Actually, any comments on that story, its accuracy, its completeness? Who wants to speak first? And sign in, please.
Yes, this is Amy.
I'll get real close to the mic and speak in a fairly loud voice.
Is that okay? Like this?
A little, actually, what we need to do is now try again.
Okay, hi. Hello.
That's good. Now we've actually got the microphone on.
So oh, good. That helps. Yeah. Little details. Right. This is Amy Courtney. And let's see, about the Sentinel article. I think it's pretty good, actually, you know, for the senile, as I like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
It shows both sides. I don't think that Tom Bush's argument, as it has come across to us in that article, it doesn't come across as being very strong. You know, some loosely grounded safety issues, and again, it fails to address why the American flag is not a safety concern when the banner was a safety concern, and they were both strung in a similar way, in a similar position, and all that. And he even points out that Caltrans has made an exception for the American flag on overpasses, to the point of saying that if we want to hang another banner, that we would need to get permission from Caltrans, but if we wanted to hang an American flag, we could just hang the American flag and all would be well.
Now, when did they remove this flag? I mean, when did all this happen? And who are we talking to now?
This is Cassandra Brown, and we put the flag up Tuesday morning.
About what time?
7 a.m.-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked away from there, got in our car, and started driving away, and within, we were driving down the freeway, and then we saw the police go down to that sign, and we pulled over, and so within 10 minutes, they had taken the flag down.
And what did you do then, Cassandra?
Ooh, how can they do that? That's what we did.
I see. Well, did you go to the police chief or the police officers?
No, what we did is we called our good friend, Paul Sanford.
An attorney who's actually working for Camp Paradise as well.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine through work, and I used to work with him, and I knew that he had done Camp Paradise, and I figured he would be a good person to ask. And so we left a message with him, and we left a message with the Metro, the Sentinel, and the Good Times. And then we waited to hear from them, and Paul Sanford called us back and said, yes, that is a First Amendment right abuse.
Mm-hmm. Did he or anybody else offer to... I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just want to say that, when it first happened, we pulled over on the freeway and we tried to take photographs with a box camera that we had from way down below. So we do have some photographs of the policemen approaching the flag and then taking it down. They're not great because they're with a box camera and we were really far away, but we did make an effort to document it. And then we got back in our car and tried to go back to confront the policeman after that just to ask him why he did what he did. But by the time we got to the next place where we could turn around and then got back to that overpass, he was gone. So,
and so was the sign.
And so was the sign.
When they got there, the cupboard was bare. Yes. Well, aren't you ashamed of causing the police of Scotts Valley all this trouble to remove these traitorous signs? Then you came back on Friday to. I read something on the internet, and I heard something from Paul Sanford when there was increasing concern about police harassment at Camp Paradise. He showed up there, and he had actually some handouts that I guess he was taking to his class to let them know about your upcoming Friday protest. What was that protest all about?
There was sort of a three-purpose element of that rally. We wanted to, A, expose that this kind of silencing of dissenting voices is happening in our community. B, we wanted to defend the very right that allows us to have free speech, the First Amendment of the Constitution. And then three, we wanted to reiterate what the whole purpose of putting the banner up was, which was the banner read, "At what cost?" And the question is, at what cost are people blindly supporting this war? And we wanted to suggest that the cost is human lives, both American and Afghani and potentially Iraqi and who knows what-y coming up, and also the cost of our civil liberties here. And oddly enough, we ended up walking right into a situation where our civil liberties were deprived of us. So
just a coincidence, I'm sure. They're simply trying to make sure that these errant sheets don't tumble down on vehicles passing by. How many people showed up at your Friday 1:30 response to the Scotts Valley Police Station?
25 to 30 people showed up for the protest.
Any colorful signs or banners?
We had a couple that we made, and then other people brought some, such as 7 million people may starve this winter in Afghanistan. First Amendment, use it or lose it. Discretionary enforcement is unpatriotic. First Amendment rights are patriotism.
And were there any counter-protesters? Do you have anybody with an American flag shouting, "Go back to Russia," or "Go back to Afghanistan," or, I don't know, "Go back to Kandahar," or Kandahar, I guess, is the last Taliban stronghold. I know that you two are big supporters of the Taliban, right?
Strangely enough, there was a man who showed up who was very upset, and there was no counter-protest, but he came out and talked to us. And he said that we were pro-Taliban and pro-Nazi, which we both thought was pretty funny, actually.
The irony being that, we feel like there's more link to his quote, actually, in the Sentinel, is that he thinks we're supporting a totalitarian dictatorial regime, and oddly enough, we thought much the same of him, so...
So you both agreed, but you disagreed on the culprit of who the regime is. I hope you're not calling our president a dictator. Don't call Christopher Cohn a Fuhrer or Tim Fitzmaurice may have you thrown out of city council meeting as he had me removed from the council chambers, because we know that our system is a transparent, democratic one in which all the people are consulted, right?
Well, I think that there's hope in Christopher Cohn. I haven't been as closely linked to the Camp Paradise sweeping ban issues as certainly you have been, but I do feel like there is hope, and hopefully now that he's got just a little bit more power, let's say, on the city council as mayor, that maybe we can see things happen, or maybe now is a good time for the community to turn up the heat on that issue. And
and on rent control, and on the Tidelands property, and on community control of police,
right.
And on funding projects that actually, like the Plaza project, and on firing the city manager, city police chief, and city attorney, all of which Cohn has done absolutely nothing about for 2.5 years in any meaningful way. So,
right, but you could equally make a laundry list of things that Cohn and others have made an attempt
to
address, and I think...
Oh, please do.
Well,
I'd love to hear that.
I think that, you're making a really good case that, like, there's a lot of things that need to get dealt with, and I think that what this really highlights is that, our political system is pretty screwed up, and so even if someone like Christopher Cohn doesn't think that it's legitimate for people to be subjected to the elements and not even be able to safely from police be able to sleep at night, that it's very difficult, if not impossible, politically to make that happen. And I'm not being an apologist for Christopher, but I do think that we're going to serve ourselves a little bit better if we can try to be, I don't know, begin his new reign as mayor in sort of a positive tone rather than an antagonistic one.
Well, I think it's important to be honest about the situation, and you're wrong. Christopher Crone could simply...
Let's be frank here.
Yeah, no, he could have put it on the agenda for that evening. He could have had it on the agenda for a special session in 2 days. He could put it on the agenda for December 13th. He will do none of these things, even though 3 years ago he and Sugar voted to suspend the sleeping and camping bans. They got burned by Catherine Byers and by Fitzmaurice at that time, and since then they've refused to lift their little finger in any way on this issue in terms of any meaningful broad protection for homeless people. It's actually not true. We forced them to put some action on the agenda in May of 2000, the safe sleeping zones. They lost by one vote, and now, though they've had the votes for a full year, they've refused to do anything. I think you're right. We should definitely indict the political system, but you also have to say that when an individual has the votes, as Christopher Crone does, but he refuses to take the action because he doesn't want to embarrass people like Marty Wormhout and other conservative Democratic centralists who are running for higher office, that you're in a position where you have to indict yourself the politicians who are failing to deal with these issues. Crone is a master. I call him a man who hides behind his kids. He's abandoned all the public meetings he used to have. He used to have a meeting every Monday before a Tuesday city council meeting. He was the only council member he did, and I commended him for it. Supervisors do this regularly. They let the public come to a meeting where they talk about their agenda to any members of the public who come. Now, I told Crone he should hold the meeting a week before that so people could actually have input into the created agenda, but at least he would have it the day before the council meeting so they could talk about what's on the real agenda. He has not done this for a full year, and he has essentially become more and more like the rest of the city council in terms of even the appearance. So I would love to believe, and you are going to give me a laundry list of all the wonderful things he's done. I actually invited Fred Geiger to do this on the air. He came up with, I think, one thing which wasn't very persuasive. I think it was the living wage, and the living wage wasn't really passed by Christopher Crone. It was passed by the entire council after massive lobbying by SEIU and other groups. So I expect council members to bring up issues that they may lose on.
I'd like to segue back to our issue in some way because it's been subverted once again by Robert North.
Hey, I'm the master of
that. But I think that
we're going to go back to your issue, no question about it.
Okay.
In fact, we can go back to it now. If at some point later you want to comment on the positive achievements of Mayor Crone. Or
no, not really. I mean, I don't want to get into a head-to-head about, whether or not Christopher Crone is a good politician or whatever. If I may.
Sure.
I think I've got the mic now.
You got one of them. Go ahead.
I was saying one could make a laundry list, and I just wanted to point out that you were making a laundry list of all the things that that's your personal list of the things that you would like to see city council address, and, there's all kinds of other issues that a lot of people could come up with, and I think that I have seen him do some good things, for sure, and I am putting hope in, but I'm not prepared
to
go into a laundry
okay.
list of what those things are, and I'm not convinced that they would impress you either, because they're probably not your issues.
Not
and,
necessarily.
But anyway, that's
I'm
not why I'm here. I'm not here to debate Christopher Crone's political career.
Of course.
But anyway, I do want to say that just the situation, well, first of all, that I do think it now's a good time for the community to put the heat on.
Definitely.
Christopher Crone, and again, I feel like there's more hope in him than there has been in a lot of the city council that I've seen in the 10 years that I've lived here.
We're
I'd also like
you to
say
bring him into line. We know that you can do it.
I'd also like to say that just looking at the condition of, last night's scramble as the river is rising and the preference of, if people are so concerned about the San Lorenzo River, then why has the boardwalk been in place where it is for so long, and why is it okay for Saul's Leather to operate right there and dump into the river? And so I think that the environmental aspect of, people saying that's why Camp Paradise shouldn't be there is a little bit of a farce, or at least reflects where people's priorities are.
And it's a sad thing that Christopher Crone responds like some kind of automaton or puppet on a string to these environmentalist concerns, and I would hope that you, perhaps as a colleague and friend of Crone's, more so than I, might be willing to be able to say, hey, Chris.
Yeah.
Get a clue.
I think that Christopher, like most people, would respond better if there weren't personal attacks being made on him. And I think in this situation, like with the flag, we made a real strong point not to attack this chief officer, Tom Bush, or the officer that took down the banner, because I don't think people get polarized that way. And I think that's going to be the same situation with Christopher Crone. But the segue here is that, you know, we look at the condition of Camp Paradise scrambling last night just to find dry land and to have a place to stay, and, you know, just the fact that they're having to deal with police enforcement of where and how they can sleep and how they can tend to their land, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the earth is made for all people, and if somebody's going to have a big chunk of land and $500,000 home where the homeless garden project used to be, while these guys are scrambling just to have dry land at night.
The Pelton Street Palace, as I used to call it. In fact, that is one of Crone's good things, but unfortunately, it was before he was on city council. Isn't that interesting?
Well, I don't know what's so interesting about that, but anyway.
Well, in other words, he didn't take, once he got on city council, he got bad. See, that's, I find that this whole thing is a corrupting influence, this whole institutional process. You
know, that's
right. It's very bad, but...
Totally. That's what I was trying to say before about the political process, but... Anyway, I mean, if we look at how our people, our community members, homeless or otherwise, are treated in our land, and then we're out there, like, as the champion of all, you know, things good, you know, it's just a farce. I mean, until we get our shit together at home and can take care of our own, why is it that we're out there pretending that we're doing everything so lovely? I mean, you know, homeless people in Afghanistan could look at the situation in the United States as in the way that women here look at the situation of women under the Taliban regime, and there's plenty of oppression happening in the United States as well. And so anyway,
well, let's return to the Friday protest. That's a good segue. Let's get back to the protest. I'll berate Christopher Crone a bit later, and by the way,
good.
It's not a personal attack, it's a political attack. I'm attacking him for his record, not for anything he's done with his family, not for anything he's done in terms of his personal habits. I'm talking about his political behavior. People like to say I'm personal, but I'm not. It's not personal. It's quite impersonal, actually. But let's get back to this protest. You came at 1:30, 25 folks kind of got together at the Scotts Valley Police Station, and how long did you guys stay there? What did you do? Cassandra.
Okay, I'm back in. let you guys kind of cool off in the corners here.
Stop.
All right. So, 25 people came, and
You gagged the police chief? I thought you weren't doing any personal attacks here.
Well, you know, a little freedom of speech issue for him, you know. See, how does that make you feel?
She's kidding.
Gag on this, Tom.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, we just, mostly what it was designed, and it was all Paul Samford's, and we are so thankful for his support and help, because we would never have done, even dreamed up this idea. And he has a lot of influence, I think, in contacting the media, and he really taught us how to do it. And so this way we got our issue out by having this political...